Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 12:44 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is November 13th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off this week with this important index. It is the MSCI World Index of companies that do substantial amounts of business in China, and it's at new all-time highs. So this raises important questions. It's another example of the reliance of the global economy on profits that arise from China, on trade with China, and obviously with it, it's another way of thinking about the exposure of the global economy to China. When we then think about, could it possibly have ever been like this during the Cold War, with, for example, Russia's or the USSR's dominance of the global economy? The answer, of course, is no, that the USSR never approximated the size of any of the major industrial powers, even though it was a major exporter of commodities. So China represents a significant challenge, because to go head-on with the second largest economy in the world, with one of the best performing asset or sources of revenue for a large number of companies, that's a significant challenge. It's not something that's just going to be taken on lightly, and it's not something that can be completed in a day or a week or a year or perhaps even a decade, because these are extremely large flows. And you're facing an uphill struggle when the asset classes that rely on China continue to do well. This is, I think, perhaps the most important point. Capital is completely amoral. Capital is global and mobile. It will flow to the most attractive asset classes in the world. And right now, that continues, or at least China continues to have a fighting chance to attract additional capital. When we think about exactly what's going on there, there are a number of factors. I did see a couple of other graphics that I think are important. This one I thought was particularly interesting. It just puts a figure on the amount of money that US companies derive from China, because it's approaching approximately $600 billion. And that's a lot of money, even in today's world where trillions seem to be thrown around with abandon. When we then think about the outlook for emerging markets, well, China represents approximately 45% of the emerging markets index. Therefore, if one is investing in emerging markets along a benchmark basis, which in fairness is the vast majority, represents how the vast majority of people invest. If one's an institutional investor, then they're always going to have an eye on their benchmark, because all they need to do is beat it by a couple of percent and they'll come out on top. Well, the other way to think about it is that they don't want to underperform their benchmark. So if the benchmark's doing well, then they kind of have to own a large part of it. Well, what it means is that even if you wanted to, if you're investing in emerging markets as a whole, then it's rather difficult to avoid owning China. Then when we think about how large is China, well, it's extraordinarily large when we start to think about the kinds of flows, because it's not only that China is a destination for imports, but it's also a major creditor. And when we talk about the quantity of money that the world owes China, well, there is a very significant debt that has now been created that the emerging world, the emerging world now owes China, or at least it owed China in 2017, which is the last time I've been able to see data from, $350 billion, and it's almost certainly going to be more today. So that's an additional point, that when we think about emerging markets, not only are they dependent on China for trade, but increasingly they're dependent on China for funding. In many respects, that's the kind of vendor financing agreements that the USA has been engaged in for a long time, that they would make money available to countries and then they would export to those countries, but not quite the same things. And they would also be a destination for imports from those countries. So that's, I think, another point that is going to make it rather difficult to really start to decouple or to even think about what that might look like. This is another way of looking at where all that money has been lent to. Well, Africa and Latin America obviously stand out, but it's pretty much all of the emerging world. And there are very significant debts owed to China, particularly you can see in all these red areas. So Pakistan stands out in sharp contrast to India. When we then think about Venezuela, it's obviously a big red mark there at the northern end of Latin America. Or Mongolia, which is the buffer state between Russia and China. And of course, China has also been lending money to Russia in order, and then has additionally been buying their oil as well. We can also look at some of these other countries, and I'm not actually can't remember which that what that one is, but this very much looks like Cambodia or Vietnam. So when we start to think about where are the debts, where are the points of influence that China may have on the rest of the world, well, debt and money is obviously a very significant trigger point, and it has been trending higher from almost nothing in 2013 to 700 billion at the end of 2019. And it isn't simply about portfolio debt, but it's also bank loans and trade credit. So, and quite significantly less of it is in foreign direct investment. So these are very, I think, significant issues that not only is China representative of a massive source of demand and trade for the global economy, it's also a significant provider of debt. It's also a significant source of exports, our export demand for the vast majority of developing markets. So then it has also been able to assert itself as the head of a number of committees in the UN. Then there is the, I guess, we're on the cusp of seeing the trade negotiations between a large number of Southeast Asian countries being ratified. President Trump pulled the USA out of that agreement and the Pan-Pacific Partnership, or I may not be getting that name exactly correct, when he took office, and it's since been renegotiated. And both Australia and Japan are part of that free trade agreement, and India is no longer part of it. So even though we have the sort of military or geopolitical agreement between Japan, Australia, the USA, and India, then two of those members are joining a free trade agreement with China. That interrelationships, even in on a trade front, are likely to test geopolitical relationships over the medium term. Money will often trump priorities in terms of morality or the reality or realpolitik of geopolitics will often be influenced by trade and money. So these are, I think, very important because it shapes how the global economy is likely to perform over time. Now, I think that this is a particularly interesting chart because we know that China has been very much more authoritarian since Xi Jinping took power. He is now the leader for life. So it was, and the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that it was a personal decision by Xi Jinping to shelve the Ant Financial IPO. A point that Mrs. Tracy has been making for years is that you can't judge China on any other metric other than politics, because they don't care about the, or they put no real weight on economic figures or on governance or rules or the performance of the stock market or the bond market or the currency, but only insofar as any of them can be viewed as a success or failure from a political perspective. And when Jack Ma stands up in front of a crowd and criticizes the regulator, well, then the snapback was both quick and abrupt and also forceful. So now we've just seen the end of the regulatory arbitrage phase of China's evolution of a technology sector. If we think about, for example, the success that Uber has had, that's, I think, one of the most or the clearest examples of regulatory arbitrage. The taxi services all over the world had, in many respects, been protected by regulation, so it was expensive to try and compete against them. And Uber just completely circumvented the rules and was able to completely do away with the taxi sector overall, and at the same time has been able to deliver a better service. But if the rules had been applied universally, then they would never have got off the ground. So that willingness to move quickly and break things is one of the hallmarks of Silicon Valley. And it has allowed incredibly large companies to evolve and to greatly enhance the quality of life and the economy and the efficiency in the economy overall. Because very often the rule-protected sectors tend to be less efficient. Well, the ability to allow companies like Alibaba and Tencent to evolve. When we think back 10 years ago, there was a clear argument that China did not have internationally competitive companies. Well, they solved that riddle by allowing regulatory arbitrage, by allowing companies access to abundant credit, to giving free rein to technology entrepreneurs, and who were actively then able to take ideas from the USA and repeat them in China under clearly protected environments. So they were willing to allow copycats to prosper incredibly and to completely do away with any enforcement of regulation for the last decade. And that allowed companies like Alibaba and Tencent to become some of the largest in the world and to be truly competitive on an international basis, not least because of the highly protected base that they're coming off of from home. And it ended this week. So now the Communist Party is unfortunately starting to become rather protectionist, in that they are now more worried about the power of these companies and their potential to disrupt the government, much less the economy. So that has been a very significant issue. What it is a clear example of is that the private sector will only be tolerated to the extent to which it furthers the political aims of the government. Now, that is really very similar to the regime that took over in Germany in the 1930s. One of the hallmarks of fascism is well, on the one hand, it is the concentration of power in a very small number of people, and the creation of, I think, a figurehead, so that all almost godlike authority. So obviously that is something that is being fostered in China today. Then there's the clear devotion of industrial production to political ends. So that is very now clear in China, as if we didn't know that that was already the case already, then we certainly know that it is the case today. We have abundant evidence of it. But it's also worth considering that the fascist regimes that took over in Europe in the 1930s, they were extremely successful in infrastructure development for exactly the same reasons that that China has been over the course of the last 30 years, because it was seen as a political imperative. The rights of the individual were subsumed to that political imperative, and it allowed for planning to be very clearly centrally organized and for massive infrastructure investment to take place. So you can walk around any city in Europe and you can still see the pieces of infrastructure that were built during their fascist histories, and most particularly in the train stations. So that also helped to steady their currencies. And the Reichsmark in the 1930s had appreciated from about 4 and a bit to 2.5. At the same time, the German stock market rallied from about 3 to 11, which, in a period where the fascist regime had taken over, they delivered on a lot of their promises. Now, there was a lot of admiration around the world for what they had achieved in terms of their infrastructure development, in terms of the way that they had been able to reassert the growth orientation of their economies and get over the incredible period of unsettled activity that was evident in the 1920s. So then that was also at a point where other economies, particularly the USA, were in the midst of a depression. So the relative comparison was really very evident as well. And there were plenty of apologists in the UK or France or the USA or Canada or Australia that were looking at some of these fascist regimes and thinking, well, golly, they must be doing something right. So that's, I think, very similar to what we're seeing with China today, because when we think about people like, for example, Ray Dalio, where he had his children educated in China, where Bridgewater is raising money for a China fund at present, and they have got the clear argument that politics is relative, and that the history of geopolitics is such that money flows to the most attractive and to the greatest yield provision around the world. So that the logical answer would be to invest in China. And particularly if you look at the performance of the stock market in Germany from 1930 through to 1941, then the answer there is yes, it was the right thing to do from a money perspective. Now, one would have had to look past the incredible atrocities that were performed upon various portions of society during that time. Now, when we think about all of that in modern terms, the rate of sterilization in Xinjiang has gone stratospheric over the last 2 years. Now, back in the 1920s and 30s, there was a clear trend of anti-Semitism. I remember my grandfather was probably a good example of the kinds of attitudes that were displayed by people at the time. He was born in 1908, so he was an adult when the Second World War broke out. And there was always a certain amount of anti-Semitism in the way that he spoke. Well, after the 9/11 and the rise of Islamic terrorism, the world appears to be willing to at least turn a blind eye to the subjugation of China's Muslim population, on the simple metric that it's not worth talking about. And that is perhaps the greatest threat to any society, is when there is an absence of discussion about any topic. Well, again, it's an additional symptom of what is going on today, because when we then think about the continued performance of Chinese assets and assets that are levered to China, well, the money is going to flow there. That's one of the primary arguments that Ray Dalio makes. And in that respect, he's correct. I personally think that there is obviously an issue with money flowing towards a market and, in fact, making a return on your money. Because volatility and political volatility is something that is very difficult to price. And then you have the individual volatility of the instruments that one invests in. So when we think about the way that people tend to invest in China, well, one would be the H-share index in Hong Kong. But if we look at that on a long-term basis, it's been extraordinarily difficult to make money there since 2008, so 12 years of ranging. And arguably, there has been a clear sequence of lower rally highs over the last 3 years, and it has not yet been broken. Well, if one were, for example, investing in the Chinese CSI 300, well, it was on the cusp of breaking higher this week, but now it seems to be coming back down again. And it's also been ranging for 12 years, and it's, although now it is towards the upper side of that range. Then if we think about the technology sector, well, the Chinext index is one of the areas where people have been investing, and it has at least been trending higher for the last 2 years, but it is now still within its own range. And of course, China is prone to these periods of extraordinary advances, and then they get knocked back, and often because of political reasons. See, the problem is that it's very hard to have confidence in regulation when it changes overnight on political whim, and that contributes to this very volatile environment. The additional contributor to volatility is the fact that there is this wide divergence between the deposit rate and the lending rate. So short-term, or I guess retail investors, have very little opportunity to earn a return unless they speculate. So they speculate in property, and then they speculate in the stock market. And that then tends to be knocked back on occasion by politics. Of course, the easy answer would be to give people more security, to give people more surety in how to invest, and to do away with that very big divergence between the lending rate and the deposit rate. But of course, it exists in order to support the banking sector. And when Jack Ma was talking about regulation, well, it does get to the crux of it, because the banks are arms of the government. So by ensuring that there is a very clear ability for banks to pick up a significant carry between what they can lend at and what they have to pay in deposits, and it means that they get to lever off of the massive deposit base, and it helps to fund the government and all of its increasing infrastructure and ambitious technology plans. So there's just no way that they're ever going to give that up. And it means then that China is going to continue to be a very volatile place to put money. So it is worth considering that when people talk about the returns from China, the best way to play that historically has been to simply bet on global companies, because they have benefited most from doing business in China. But the dearth of governance in China makes it rather difficult to, in fact, make money there. So when we're presented with this question about, well, we know that there is rising dominance of China on the global economy, and we know that it is increasingly a center for innovation on the technology front and accessing its very large domestic market, then that's a siren call for investors. It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that people are in fact going to make money there. And that is, of course, unless one has a clear line on what the government and what senior party officials are in fact going to allow to do well. So there will be a small number of people that will do very well in China, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody will. When we then think about what's going on today in China with regard to the coronavirus and the global economy, the renminbi has been strengthening quite abruptly over the last 6 months. And there's a good reason for that. China has come through the pandemic in better shape than most of the other big countries in the world. But they made a clear determination. Back in 2008, China basically bailed out the whole global economy. They held their currency absolutely steady for 2 years, and they pumped trillions into the Chinese economy so that demand from China helped to reinvigorate demand for commodities. If we go back and look at the continuous commodity index from that period, commodities rebounded in incredibly robust form after 2008 because China bailed out the global economy. And following the massive decline, commodities went on to new all-time highs. So they made a clear determination on this occasion that they are not going to do that again, because it created bubbly activity in the shadow banking sector. They've had to snuff that out. It created the threat of a bubble in the housing market, and they've had to introduce a lot of measures to try and reduce speculation in housing. So there were massive sources of overcapacity. There were cities built for nobody, and that was obviously a very significant challenge to overcome. So now China is running tight monetary and fiscal policy, much tighter than everywhere else. That's putting upward pressure on the renminbi, and it's one of the clearest reasons for why yields have been pushing up too. Because China looks likely that they're going to raise interest rates before anybody else, and the 10-year yield continues to trend higher. Now, of course, that means that bond prices are coming down. But when we start to think about what exactly is going on, well, again, international investors, they would much prefer to buy a strong currency with a strong yield than they would a weak currency with no yield. So there is certainly an argument for why investors would prefer to own Chinese debt than US debt, because even if one goes out to 30-year maturities, well, US debt is still trading at 1.6%, which is really rather low on an historic basis. So I think that's an additional point that's worthy of consideration. If we start to think then about how much money the USA is spending, well, it's on par with the kind of spending seen in the aftermath of World War II. So that does suggest that there is ample scope for it, dependence on the USA to bail the global economy out. So I think there is obviously then the decision by China that they've come through the pandemic better than everybody else, and they have absolutely every intention of gaining the best possible utility from that. So they're going to try and make the best of a bad situation. And when we think then about what can we anticipate from the USA, well, we can think about the size of the deficit that was taken on in the global financial crisis and now recently, and the size of the deficit for the COVID pandemic is on par with that for World War II. But every other time that deficits have increased by this measure, they have contracted subsequently. So this massive spending is not going to persist next year. And we know that after World War II, the stock market went sideways for a significant period of time. If China does not end up with a big debt problem as a result of the coronavirus, it means then that their economy is going to be in a better position as well. And that is another factor that could potentially attract money in there. But I think perhaps the easiest way to play it is going to be to look at the countries that benefit from China doing well. Because what we have with the Asia Dollar Index is a clear pattern of renewed interest. And this index trended downwards for a decade, and now it has broken its sequence of lower rally highs. So we're in a very different scenario overall. And as recently as this year, the index had returned to test the level seen in 2004. So with China exhibiting relative strength, then that is removing a significant headwind from the rest of Asia, so they can allow their currencies to appreciate as well. When we think about the performance of a number of regional markets, well, the South Korean market has rebounded in very impressive form and is now coming back to test at the region of its peaks from 2 years ago. But it's important to, I think, highlight that the Korean market had peaked in 2008 and then went sideways for most of the next decade. It had just broken out before we started to see the trade war coming through in 2018 and 19, and subsequent to that, it has rebounded in very emphatic fashion. The Taiwanese market had spent decades going sideways, formed a first step above the base in 2018 and 19, and now it's at new all-time highs. Of course, it's being led higher by the clear dominance of Taiwan Semiconductor in the semiconductor index. They've been able to perfect the production of 5-nanometer chips. Intel has fallen behind, and they are now only producing 10-nanometer chips. So that has been one of the clear factors in the underperformance of the sector. Of course, Taiwan represents a very attractive acquisition potential for China. If there has been a geopolitical or it's an idealistic wish from China to reunite Taiwan with the mainland for as long as the Communist Party has been in charge. But today they have a geopolitical imperative because Taiwan is far and away the most dominant place in the world for manufacturing semiconductors. They really have been incredibly successful. And a lot of that infrastructure is not for sale in China. When we think about ASML, they are the company that produces the machines that produce the semiconductors, and they just don't sell them in China. But they do sell them in Taiwan. Well, if Taiwan were ever to become part of China again, then one of the dearest wishes of the Communist Party is to have a large domestic semiconductor at the semiconductor sector. And if they can't develop it themselves because it's extraordinarily expensive and takes decades of R&D, well, the best one in the world is only across the Taiwan Strait. Now, what we saw this week in Hong Kong was that China used the interregnum period between President Trump and President-elect Biden handing over power to one another to almost completely dissolve the Hong Kong Parliament. So the entire opposition resigned en masse. So again, this is another example of how major geopolitical tensions increase when domestic factors force politicians to take their eye off the international ball. It seems inevitable that this trend will eventually end in war, but it w is unlikely to end in war until China is ready to start it, because they may not be there yet in terms of their military prowess, or they may not be there yet in terms of their ability to sustain themselves during a period of conflict. So the two things to pay particular attention to in order for China's administration to tick the boxes they need in order to start a major war would be energy and semiconductors. Because if they lose access to semiconductors, then they can't develop their technology sector. But the USA is a major energy exporter, and China is the largest energy importer. If we think about what the reasons are for China to adopt a carbon neutral strategy by 2050, then the rationale is clear. It's not so much that the Chinese administration has suddenly turned into a Greenpeace green warrior. Again, it has to be viewed in terms of politics, and it's clearly a determination that by adopting a green or a carbon-free mandate for the next 30 years, that they can become energy independent. And at the same time, they can appeal to the left-leaning administrations around the world that they are conforming to the demands of populations around the world to enhance their green credentials. So it is very much a two birds with one stone type of environment. What it means is that at some point in the next decade to 20 years, there will be a war. And at that point, the stock market will close. And just like what happened after the war ended and the stock market opened again, if China loses that war, then all investments in the country will be completely wiped away. On the other hand, if China were to win that war, well, then as soon as the stock market opens again, stocks would start to do better. And then the question is, well, will China win or not? We are now engaged in a great deal of navel gazing domestically in the West. I think there has been a loss of a unifying principle. And part of the reason for that has been the march of technology, which has been inherently deflationary, and it has discomfited a large number of people so that they just don't have clear ways to generate income on their own any longer. And living standards have contracted at exactly the same time that living standards all over the rest of the world have improved beyond recognition. It's going to take time and potentially some significant social and domestic unrest and the continued rise of populism to really try and correct some of the factors that are contributing to this loss of animus, or I guess this loss of a unifying principle around which society can coalesce in the West. Because the West has lost the belief in politics, has lost the belief in religion, and it hasn't been really replaced by anything just yet. Raw consumerism just does not get the job done. There has to be the kind of environment where people start to believe once more in the ask not what you can do for your, or what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That kind of way of thinking is largely absent today, but will have to be revitalized, because otherwise then it is autocratic, despotic regimes are literally going to take over. And that is perhaps the biggest threat out there. What we are definitely seeing, however, is that people are starting to hedge the exposure to that potential scenario. And Bitcoin is cruising through 16,000. So this is a clear breakout from what was a well-defined range. This isn't the first time that Bitcoin has been through a 3-year consolidation, and the last time it did phenomenally well afterwards. But what we can definitely think about is that it is no longer just about retail investors. With the introduction of institutional investors, Fidelity announced the introduction of institutional custody facilities about 18 months ago. PayPal announced yesterday that they're going to make crypto holdings a feature of their platform for all retail investors. So that's obviously an additional significant impetus, and it lends credibility to the sector. But of course, Bitcoin also is completely independent. And when we start to think then about how sustainable is that, if there are real threats, and if Bitcoin becomes a haven out of which or starts to sap interest in fiat currencies, then there's a clear potential that it will get legislated against. But at the same time, there will probably be increasing interest where governments look at everything they can gain from Bitcoin, and most particularly, it's a war on cash. And with the digitization of all transactions, well, then that increases revenue generation capacity for all governments. When we think about the fact, for example, that Italy has got a black economy the same size as all of Portugal's, or how many times have people called the plumber and paid in cash for a discount? Well, if that is only possible with cash, and without cash, then everything becomes digitized. Auditing individuals becomes a matter of course. Application of artificial intelligence and deep learning makes the entire process of tax collection automatic, This is obviously something that becomes extremely attractive to central bankers because they then have almost complete control over how people are using their money. They get complete visibility on what people are doing with their money, and then they have absolute control over supply. So it's inevitable that we're going to move towards digital currencies because it makes so much sense for governments and for central banks. The problem that Bitcoin has is that the more successful it is, the more likely it is that there will be the same kind of appropriation of Bitcoin from investors as there was from gold holdings in the 1930s. Whereas gold itself is at least a physical asset, they cannot reach into your digital wallet and take it away from you. And that is a good reason why gold is a preferred asset overall. It's the one clear benefit to a physical asset, that it is the very fact that it is not digital is the clearest reason why anyone would want it. And we are certainly in a bull market. But at the same time, I do think that Bitcoin is likely to do very well before it becomes a problem for governments. And something that we've clearly got evidence of is that it is trading in a manner similar to gold. So gold prices broke out back in the middle of 2019. Then when we think about the bigger gold miners, those that have got the better resources or have got histories of paying dividends, then that completed its base formation 9 months later and broke out in March. Then silver started to do well, and it took its cue from the gold miners. And as gold miners started to do well, then appetite for silver started to pick up, so it broke out in July of this year. When we think about the outlook for gold, it might be a while yet, at least until we start to see some of these ranges being completed before the explorers start to do better. But explorers are still within their base formations overall. Now, if we think about what's happening with cryptocurrencies, well, Bitcoin has now broken out, and it really only just broke out in the last 4 weeks. Then, when we think about the outlook for Ethereum, which we could say is a high beta version of Bitcoin, well, it is now just coming up to the upper side of its first step above the base. So, in many respects, Ethereum is behaving like the gold miners. But we are still early in the outlook for the cryptocurrencies because Bitcoin has only just broken out. And then when we look at the performance of the altcoins, those that are what would be considered in many respects the explorers section of the cryptocurrency market, well, Litecoin, for example, is still within its base formation. IOTA, which is another one of the promising product, or I guess projects that are out there, is also still within its base formation. Well, what this is suggesting is that yes, there is interest in the cryptocurrency markets right now, and interest is spread because Ethereum looks like it is on the cusp of completing that first step above the base. But we're still really very early in this move, and Bitcoin has not broken out to new all-time highs yet. But if it does break successfully above 20,000, and at this stage I see no reason why it would not, then that is likely to reignite interest in the smaller coins. And the ones that are exhibiting relative strength today and are beginning to do better, well, then it's likely that those will be the first that investors start plowing their money into. For example, Ripple was one of the cryptocurrencies that was most taken up by banks back in 2016 and 17, and then it gave up all of its advance. But it is now back above its trend mean, and it is really only just beginning to steady once more. And I think the most important thing to highlight is that some of these are the equivalent of penny stocks, and they're trading at a quarter of a dollar at present. So it doesn't take a lot of money to buy a lot of them. And these are, I think, some of the factors that are starting to occur right now. What we've also seen is that Chinese people are starting to flood into embassies in China looking for visas. They anticipate a new cultural revolution in China. Now, that's something that is not getting a lot of credence in the West, but they see the writing on the wall, and they see the control that is being exerted by the Communist Party. So they're worried today. Now, we don't see any evidence yet and of any kind of pressure on that regard in the stock markets. What we do know is that the agricultural prices are doing better. Commodity-related currencies are on the cusp of breaking out of bases and completing a decade-long races, decade-long downtrends. When we think about the agricultural commodity index, then what we have are these just incredible commonalities between the performance of Latin American currencies and the performance of agricultural commodities. The reality is that China is going to be certainly importing more soybeans and probably corn as well. And then they have also got a significant shortage of pork and poultry. So in order to control the domestic population, they need to ensure that they're well fed, and that and particularly in view of the fact that when the communists came in, they destroyed almost every part of China's traditional heritage, but they kept the food because it's by far the most important thing to Chinese people. And when we think then about what demand is likely to be for the agricultural resources like soybeans or corn, well, we're increasingly seeing evidence of base formation completion in the grains and beans. When we then think about sugar, it is also looking like it's on the cusp of completing a 3-year base formation. When we think about coffee, China is not a massive consumer of coffee, but coffee is addictive, so then demand does tend to rise over time, and Robusta coffee has bounced from the region of the trend mean. When we think about vices or addictive types of products and in the agriculture sector, well, cannabis does look like it is beginning to turn. Canopy Growth Corp has broken up and out of this little range. There is some speculation, at least, that with the new administration in the USA, there will be less regulation of cannabis overall. When we think about the size of some of these companies. Well, Canopy Growth Corp is one of the largest at nearly 12 billion, but the rest have gone through a significant process of consolidation. Trulieve Cannabis has been one of the best performers recently. And part of the reason for that is that they did something quite akin to what Google did and avoided the bubble and listed after the crash. And the share broke out in June of this year and it is now at a new all-time high. So there are some companies that have been able to circumvent the massive crash and rationalization that the sector has undergone and are coming out and reaping the benefits today. I do think that that is a good example of what we're likely to see as the coronavirus ebbs. There has obviously been a great deal of media commentary over the course of the last 2 weeks about the rising number of cases, but the only country I've seen where the number of deaths is increasing rapidly is Italy, and everywhere else seems to have the number of deaths under control. Obviously, there are challenges with continuing to deal with the pandemic, but the one thing that we've seen in here this week was some really quite positive news on the vaccine front. One thing that's, I think, important to think about is that when we look at the success that we've had with Pfizer, well, Pfizer anticipates having approximately 100 million doses produced in 2020. But they anticipate having 1.3 billion by 2021. Now, companies like AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are already producing their vaccine as well. Now, in the possibility that they, in fact, are approved either early next year or late this year, well, then what we're looking at is the potential for just four companies to have enough vaccine produced to inoculate the vast majority of the world. Now, obviously, not all the world is going to get inoculated immediately, but it is quite likely that the vast majority of the developed world could be inoculated by the middle of next year. So we have to remember that as these scare stories continue to come out about the rising number of cases and the threat of lockdown continues to increase. I've certainly seen that in supermarkets around Los Angeles, there are definitely more people and demand for things like water and toilet paper is starting to rise again. So that is obviously a clear example of people worrying about the potential for additional lockdowns. And yet, stock markets are discounting mechanisms. So they are going to look at what the possibilities are 6 months out. And 6 months from today, it's very likely that vaccines are going to be rolled out and that social distancing measures will be relaxed. And we will be looking at economic recovery and that a lot of the companies that have been under extraordinary duress, some will obviously have gone bust, and the remainders are going to be those that had a stronger position or a closer position to government, but they will all of the survivors will have greater market share to compete for. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.